On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Deep in the Moscow subway, Russians moving beneath a world of snow and crime are reporting seeing the ghost of Joseph Stalin alive and kicking. And with that plot charge, novelist Martin Cruz Smith is off and running in his latest dark thriller set in the Moscow underworld. Since his best-selling Gorky Park way back in the Cold War days, this detective story master has mined Russia's half-buried crimes and wounded culture. Now, with Vladimir Putin on the way to see George Bush, he's at it again. Up next on Point, novelist Martin Cruz Smith on deep history, dark Russia, and Stalin's ghost. Joining me today from Boulder, Colorado, is Martin Cruz Smith. He's penned 11 books, and Stalin's Ghost makes 12. His earlier works include Wolves Eat Dogs, Red Square, Polar Star, and the 1981 global bestseller Gorky Park. He's been compared to Graham Greene, Dostoevsky, and John le Carré in bringing a compelling literary and political eye to detective fiction. Martin Cruz Smith, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Been reading you for a long time. Tell us a little bit about your new story, Stalin's Ghost. What's going on here?
Well, I found myself sort of inadvertently becoming a kind of a chronicler of Russia without any intention, but here I am with stories that seem to be coming full circle. I've gone through the period of the great exuberant period of early Yeltsin and the buffoonery of later Yeltsin. And now the rise of Putin brings us a little bit closer to where we were in the very beginning.
There's so much we want to learn, but give us a sense of the kind of framework of this story. First of all, your now famous fictional detective, Arkady. Do you say Arkady Rinko is back? Is that how you pronounce it?
I say Arkady.
Okay.
I don't correct other people.
Well, say it how you like then, but he's back, and what's he up against this time?
Well, he's up against... He's up against a prosecutor, his own boss, who would love to do away with Renko. He's got a woman that he's living with who is taken up with another man. He's got a chess prodigy and a young boy who seems to be fairly dangerous. And then he's got a society which seems to be headed in the wrong. Well, let's put it this way: people call it Putin. Putin Stalin light. And there's some truth to that. He's headed back to an authoritarian society, one that he thought he'd left long ago.
Stalin light. It's got all that going on. And as you put right in your title on this book, Stalin's Ghost, actually, at least so the Muscovites in the book are saying, showing up in the Moscow subway. What?
I wondered about that. I was on the Moscow subway, and when I go to the Moscow subway, I tend to spend a fair amount of time there because my command of the Russian language is next to nothing. And so I'm reading the Cyrillic alphabets and going from station to station, getting lost and getting pushed against the walls. And it occurred to me, what would happen? What would it be like if Muscovites started seeing the ghost of Joseph Stalin waving benignly at them as they went by the platform?
But everything here is politically loaded, including history. You write, stick your shovel into the ground in Moscow, and you take your chances.
Well, you take your chances. I have a wonderful scene. I'd love to read to you, if only I could find my reading glasses. a wonderful scene in which they're digging underneath the Supreme Court building.
Right, and it's layer after layer of bodies down there.
Down there. And suddenly, well, it's a little bit embarrassing. It's the kind of work you want to be doing excavation at night. And the question finally Arkady asks is, as he joins the scene of onlookers who are refusing to move away, he asks, well, you know, the problem is once you start digging in Moscow, when do you stop?
You take us to Stalin and to a metro station which has particular significance. Americans learn a lot about the London Blitz, but you take us back to a moment in Stalin's history when Nazi Germany was really pressuring their capital city hard, and Stalin ended up in the subway himself. I think that's actually historically accurate. Tell us about that.
Well, I found I do this kind of work in part because it's so much fun. I mean, just digging up the past yourself as a writer is exhilarating, and you come upon these little treasures of information, such as the fact that the Moscow subways were made dug particularly deep in case of war, and when war came, they moved to a metro station called Chisti Prudny. Mm. And there was the war room of the Soviet Russia in a subway station.
Stalin himself sleeping on a cot on the platform there, the general staff in subway cars.
And as the train would go through the track, everyone had to put their hands down and keep the papers from maps from floating away. And there was something about the way they just sort of put things together. The way they sort of it's as if you and I decided let's go to war with somebody, and we hadn't really planned completely. We'll make do. It was a make do war room, and we remember all those pictures of Churchill in the Blitz in this with these people tracking mm-hmm. the Luftwaffe
sure.
as they
sure.
came over the. And there's FDR in the White House, and here was Joseph Stalin just muttering to his generals about the advance of the Wehrmacht, and who were only about 10 miles away from his metro station.
There you have one of your characters say of that station where his ghost later appears in your book, "This place should be like Lourdes with people on their knees." Back to that history again. Under the Supreme Court, in the dark of night, they're digging bodies out of the foundation. You've got a character saying from the clothes, it looks like they're killed in the 40s or 50s, holes in the back of the head in the basement of the Supreme Court yet. March you right downstairs and boom, that's how they used to do it. You know, at this point, with Gorky Park coming out in 1981 and you having started that book well before 1981, you've been paying attention to Russian history for a long time. How do you describe the moment we're looking at right now? The world's sort of looking on, trying to figure out what is up with this country.
Well, I think that what we've got here is a return to a... it's not America. We're constantly trying to define Russia by American terms or the English language, and it has to be done in the Russian language. And I've been reading a wonderful book myself called Pushkin's Button. And it's about Pushkin and much of it, his relationship to authority, which is the Tsar Alexander II. Mm. And there is simply an obeisance to power that Russians make that Americans do not. And we have to keep that in mind, that, you know, what's happening now is a return to authoritarian power, with which Russians are more comfortable than we are.
Describe the investigator that you put into this scenario and all of the books you've sent in Russian, Arkady Renko. He is forged in that Russian culture. I wish you'd give us a little miniature portrait of your detective, your investigator.
Well, he's a man who absorbs a lot of punishment. I haven't really counted up the things that I put him through.
A lot in this book, in Stalin's Ghost. I mean, his head opened up practically.
And what he's got going for him is a sense of humor. It's a black humor, granted, but he tends to see the ridiculous in his situation, even except with exceptions of his nearly son, Zhenya, who's a chess prodigy and a wild boy, and the woman that he's with, Eva. And he tends to get in the middle of the. Remember the young man who stood in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. Arkady
sure.
tends to, without meaning to be that man, he tends to be in the wrong place, for me, the writer, at the right time.
But his father was a great Soviet general. He himself was a Communist Party member. What is it about the character of this character that puts him there like the Chinese young man before the tank?
Well, he's got an incurable honesty about him. And he tends to contain a germ, I would say, of his father, a seed of his father, who was a brutal man and a violent man, And there is some of that hidden inside Arkady that he can call on from time to time. In this book, I go much more into that relationship between Arkady and the general than I've done before. And so it's a much more revealing sort of story and a freer kind of story. And it's much more about it's not just about society. It's about a man finding himself in his father and his almost son.
Martin Cruz Smith, you say we make a mistake in imposing kind of American presumptions on Russia. But what about you in making your detective that one individual who stands up in front of the tank or a sometimes monstrous culture? Is that a kind of American wish, an American vision that you've planted in the heart of your Russian investigator, detective?
Well, I think that, you know, the question, a good Russian is, how Russian is Arkady? Is he really just an American who happens to speak Russian? And I hope I've created somebody real. And so the way I check that is I run my Russian Arkady by Russian friends. Could this man exist? And a long time ago, I was much more bothered by this question, and I asked a friend of mine, Yuri, who had spent some time in the camps, whether he could imagine anybody like Arkady in Russian society. And Yuri said, "Well, his best friend in Leningrad was just exactly the same man, and a senior investigator, but an honest man." So I felt it was, if he was okay with Yuri, he was okay with me.
Let's go to John in New Haven, Connecticut. John, you're on the air with Martin Cruz Smith.
Hello. I just want to thank Martin Cruz Smith for the wonderful job he does in exploring cross-cultural differences, not just in his recent books, but in the earlier ones. I loved Nightwing and Gypsy and Amber as well. But I think we don't pay enough attention to cross-cultural differences, and I think it's great the job he does.
That's terrific, John. Thanks very much for that. Martin Cruz Smith, it's true. I mean, you're associated so powerfully with Moscow and Russia because of Gorky Park and all the rest, but you've gone after, Los Alamos nuclear facilities and Native American culture. You've gone in Tokyo Station to the period just before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. You've followed Renko down to Havana and Cuba. Do you see yourself as a cross-cultural explorer, explainer, as John suggests?
Well, I like the idea that I'm an explorer, in fact, besides an explainer, because I always like to see the other side. There tends to be another side. Whenever we played Cowboys and Indians as children, I was always chose to be the Indian. Partly because I am part Indian, but also because there was something so much more interesting on the other side and the dark side. So I wanted to. When I went to Moscow, in fact, back in 1973, it was written about it. I'd read about it as a fortress, a monolith. Mm. And I got there and I saw this fascinating city of grayness, yes, but of intense friendship the consequences to having friends and trusting them carried consequences. I fell in love with this bizarre, dark society, and the people in it. And the same is true of the Japanese before Pearl Harbor and what they thought they were doing. I asked myself at that time, why did they go to war in a war they couldn't win? Trying to delve into that psyche was fascinating enough for me. I think if I could write these books, and they were never published, but if I were just allowed to write them, I'd enjoy myself almost as much.
Tell us about the new one, In Stalin's Ghosts. History plays a very important part, and I wish you'd take us into a setting or two from history that becomes most vivid and important in this story. I mean, some of it is very recent in Chechnya. Some of it is not recent. It goes back to what Russians call the Great Patriotic War, World War II, and a tremendous battlefield graveyard. I wish you'd give us just a taste of how those elements from history factor in and why they're important in your very contemporary story.
Well, the you are uncovering the past. There's always an effort to cover the past and an effort to uncover the past. And in a town called Tver was a great battlefield that really determined the course of the war.
Along the Volga River there.
along the Volga River, a couple of hours north of Moscow, and a favorite haunt of Pushkin, in fact, during those halcyon days.
Yeah.
And there are two groups in this town called Tver, the Red Diggers and Black Diggers. The Red Diggers are digging up the remains of Russian soldiers who died in the Great Patriotic War and returning them to their families.
A kind of nationalist patriotic mission that they're on.
Yes, a reclaiming of souls. Because if you were not found, if your body was not found, then you were counted among those who were traitors and had gone over to the other side.
And this is actually happening, the Red Diggers.
This is happening. Mm-hmm. This is happening. Mm-hmm. And then there are the Black Diggers, who are digging up the remains of World War II, the same battles, and digging up the helmets and the insignia and the weapons. They sell them on eBay. So we have here sort of an overlapping of the horror of war and then the commercial possibilities and then the reclaiming of souls. And it is, at the same time, a battle that turned the course of the war.
So a kind of almost religious patriotism in that battlefield, right next to eBay, scavengers, stripping bodies of medals and helmets and buckles and clothing.
And this is at the same time in the town of Tver, which is one of the most patriotic towns in Russia and sends its full complement of boys off to the war in Chechnya. So there's a particular tragic quality to this because they're also the most amenable or vulnerable to the nationalism which has returned to Moscow. They have their own uniform. There's a very military cast to the people in the town. It's a poor town. It's a town of bikers and tattoos, and it's sort of a cast adrift in the tides of history. And you have to kneel and get on your knees and thank them for saving the world. Mm. At the same time, sort of lament the fact that they've been taken advantage of politically.
Mm, thank them for saving the world in the face of the Nazi Germany's armies. Martin Krusmith, I want to ask you about a really interesting speech that Vladimir Putin gave just last week in Russia. I don't know if you followed the news reports of it, but here he is. He's had very contentious relations with Washington and even his old buddy George Bush, who looked into his eyes all those years ago and saw a good man there. He stood up in Russia and made a big speech about the star ghost of your new book, Joseph Stalin. And he said that nobody in the world should try to make Russia feel guilty about the Great Purge of 1937, saying, look, in other countries, even worse things have happened, Putin said. We're coming up on the 70th anniversary, of course, or we're in the midst of it, of all that. This is when, hundreds of thousands were killed under Stalin, millions thrown into the slave labor camps. And Vladimir Putin says, yes, we had terrible pages. Let us recall the events since 1937. Let us not forget that. But in other countries, it has been said it was more terrible. What do you make of the Russian leader, after all the history we've seen, standing up and kind of defending 1937, or at least saying, hey, nobody else should throw stones at us?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think it's ridiculous and horrifying on the face of it. Here's a man, Stalin killed 20 million, let's say, of his own countrymen, starved 7 or 8 million Ukrainian people to death, and led the purges and signed off on checklists in which he assigned quotas to towns. He didn't need names. He just wanted quotas. And, of course, the communist party cadres in these different towns would say, well, we can even overfulfill the quota. So they would up the number of people. And it was a time of denunciation. And it was strangely, however, and we tend to forget this, a time of the greatest idealism in the Soviet Union, and how you can carry both ideas in your mind that you or your neighbor may be arrested the next day. At the same time, you're rebuilding the world. It's a contradiction that it's a Russian contradiction and something that it's very hard for us to get a grasp on. And what they've seen in the meantime after Stalin was, well, they look at Stalin, they say he took us from a barefoot nation, a backward nation, and he made us a superpower and he made us respected in all the world. So they have this sort of nostalgia for that. And they have a nostalgia for something else, which is that under Stalin, it was a society of, well, it was a fairly classless society. And they said that some people had an extra vacation, they had a better ration for food or a better cafeteria to go to. But it was a system of perks, not wealth. And what they look at now is they see they have a class society now, and the upper class tend to be a pack of thieves. So there's a lot of anger in one hand and nostalgia in the other, and amnesia as well. Because this is, you know, but this combination is something that we have to learn to live with.
Let me quote a little more of Putin to you, I want to know the because there. But here he is saying that he regrets that Russia's history textbooks have, some of them have been written using grants from foreign groups. He was implying that foreign governments were dictating how Russian history should be told. He said textbook authors, quoting the Russian leader, dance to the polka that others have paid for. Then he said we shouldn't forget that there were grim chapters in Russian history, but he said no one must be allowed to impose the feeling of guilt on us. Let them think about themselves. Then he seemed to point to the United States, not directly, but he said we have not used nuclear weapons against a civilian population, thinking Japan, I guess. We have not sprayed thousands of kilometers with chemicals or dropped on a small country seven times more bombs than in all the great patriotic war, World War II, thinking, I guess, of Vietnam. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, I think he's give the devil his due. He has some points there to begin with. But don't lose sight that this is a smokescreen. I mean, the favorite phrase of Joseph Stalin was, when you cut wood, chips fly, making the chips the equivalent of human lives. And we'd better be able to defend ourselves polemically. But at the same time, be aware that this is something that Putin is doing. You know, he's using Joseph Stalin's ghost, if it be, and welcoming him home. And he's going to do this again and again, because in part that's they have like two cards to play. One of them is oil, and the other one is he's very canny use of our leader George. George is a man who went into got into the ring with very little training, and Putin is a very sly guy. He's not even a boxer. He's a judo martial arts expert. So he will use our strength against us.
Former KGB guy. Let's go to Orangeburg, South Carolina, and Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the air with Martin Krusmith.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to say that Rinko is such a favorite character of mine that I named my dog Rinko.
All right, a dog and a detective. Why do you love this kind of cynical, psychologically pressed, hard-bitten, slogging detective so much, Linda?
He just seems so sympathetic. He's a sympathetic character. He's had so much hard times, and, you know, he just grabbed me right off the bat. First book I read, Gorky Park, and I followed it straight on through, and I've also read anything else that I can get my hands on by Martin Krusmith. I think he's a powerful writer.
He's made a name for your dog. Is he your kind of man, Arkady Rinko? Would you like to know this guy?
Yeah, I would. I think he'd be great to sit around and have a cup of coffee with, maybe a shot of vodka.
And what about the Russia that he works in? How do you look at it, Linda, from your American Orangeburg vantage?
Well, my dad was a patrolman, a highway patrolman for 33 years, so yeah. I like the connection. I think he's an honorable man, and he's working in a place that is very difficult to be that way. But I mean, that's the same way here. My dad went through the same thing, so.
Yeah, we hear it from somebody who knows something about police work. Linda, that's great. Martin Krusmith, there's a dog named Rinko, and he's practically named for you and your guy.
Well, I am almost afraid to ask, but what kind of a dog is Rinko?
He's a mutt.
Perfect. I think that's the best choice.
Perfect. I think so. We live out in the country. People drop dogs out there all the time, and take them in and fix them and take care of them.
That's great. Linda, thanks very much for calling. Martin Krusmith, talk about the history that Rinko has lived through at this point. You began writing Gorky Park in the early 1970s. You were supposed to write a book with an American lawman at the center of it. You got swept up in your imagination with this Russian, got into a big fight with your publisher because of that. It went through all kinds of tortured trail before it came out because you fell in love with Rinko. What is, when you look at him in terms of Russian history, he's lived through a lot of different phases now. Describe them, and what's he facing today?
Well, and in terms of the Rinko and the history, you're right. He's lived through it, and the books have. I never intended to do even a second book about Rinko because I thought I'd done Russia. But then Russia began to change. I tried to get back in, and this is during the days of Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get back in and could not. And so I found a piece of Russia floating around the Bering Sea in the shape of a factory ship. I got on that. The KGB caught up with me and knocked me off of it.
This was in Polar Star. You were pursuing the
other one. So I was able to catch the beginnings of that breakup because the captain himself, Captain and I had a deep talk. He'd found out who I was and that he was not supposed to be talking to me, but he took it upon himself to take that chance and let me on board his ship.
Until they had re-anked you off somewhere, I believe, in Alaska.
Yeah. And so then I was welcomed back as an author of Perestroika, and I got a big bear hug from the generals, which made me a little queasy. I felt more comfortable on the deck of the ship than I did in the paws of the bears. And then things continued to move, and then I was interested in the breakup of Cuba and Russia, which was a very bitter one. So it allowed me to take Arkady to Havana, and it's a sort of a vacation, let's say, from Moscow, and then brought him back in time for Chernobyl to go to Chernobyl. Mm. So I've gone through Russian history as a sort of a traveler, you know, somebody who's hiking through the mountains, never knowing what's going to come next, but knowing that, you know, he's found by pure happenstance, by pure luck. Some fascinating journey.
Let's go to Dennis in Needham, Massachusetts, for just a second. What do you say, my friend?
I say that the descriptive writing in Polar Star ranks right up there with Jack London and other great writers of, you know, bleakness and wilderness and survival under extreme conditions. I can conjure up those images out on the ice pack, quite easily. So I just tuned in, so somebody may have already said this.
No, they haven't. Snow and cold and ice, and Martin Cruz Smith took you there. Are you still reading this? Even when Rinko goes to Havana, do you like him in the sunshine, too?
I got the book on order as soon as I saw that it was out.
Oh, Stalin's Ghost? Okay, coming to you. Dennis, thanks very much for calling. Let's take a call from Boston. And Tatiana, you're on the air with Martin Cruz Smith.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hello.
It's wonderful to hear a conversation with Mr. Cruz Smith. After all these years, and I'm an early fan of his, I haven't read the book that you have just mentioned, but I look forward to reading it and look forward to meeting Arkady Rinko again. But I must say that as a human being, maybe even a fictitious one, Arkady Rinko is much more fortunate than the real former KGB or other investigators in the Russian military.
What do you mean by that, Tatiana? What do you mean?
Well, it occurred to me that there is even an interesting, you know, juxtaposition of Alexander Litvinenko.
The dead Russian in London.
Your discussion reminded me of his fate, and he was of KGB, but apparently more honest than most of the other people over there, including President Vladimir Putin himself. And not to brag, but just wanted to mention, to put myself in context, I am a Russian. I mean, I'm an American citizen.
Yeah.
I came to this country in 77, and I'm a stepdaughter of Andrei Sakharov, whose name I'm sure would be familiar to both you and Mr. Smith.
Of course. Wow.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I really appreciated what Mr. Smith said about today's Russia and Mr. Putin personally. But I feel that Mr. Putin had the agenda and the objective early on when he just came to power to really dismantle the remains or the shoots, the early starts of civil society in Russia. And the notion of great country, of giving back the great country, the great empire to the Russian people, is a very fallacious one, because he wants to suppress the historic memory of what the past has truly been. And I think the textbooks and the you know, the discussion on textbooks and dancing polka to the music of those who pay for it is precisely you know, a symptom of that mentality. He would like to tailor the Russian past to his own notions of what Russia should be. And what is, after all, a great country? That is the question. You know, what is the greatness of one's country? And though I want to finish now, but I wanted to say that I agree with Mr. Smith that he's got some good points about America and the problems we are facing, but we do not face the same type of suppression of freedom of speech, and your show is a proof of that, I think.
Tatiana, that's all terrific. It's wonderful stuff, and we'll look at it. Say hello to Uncle Sakharov for us, and we appreciate your call. Martin Cruz-Smith, there you are. Let's go first to the kind of, well, Tatiana says your Renko is luckier than most old police state leftovers by far, and she looks at the dead Russian in London with, what was it, some kind of radioactive pill in his drink.
Polonium. Yes. I wish he'd chosen cesium-137, but he chose polonium.
That's as good as it gets, even for a thriller writer, I would think. Is it not, leaving that radioactive trail all over Europe?
It's spectacular, and meant to be spectacular, meant to cow people with it, sort of the mystery of radioactive poison. One point I want to make, we've been talking about this thing that Putin said about dancing to a different drummer. And what he's talking about there, decoded,
that is dancing to the polka that others have paid for when they fund Russian history books, textbooks.
Yes, exactly. And what he's talking about is the Ukraine. What he's talking about, because in the election that went not their way, but our way.
The Orange Revolution.
The Orange Revolution. That was in part the result of an influx of American money, an influx of American lawyers, who made sure there was an honest election. And this was much resented in the Kremlin. So this is not just an offhand, soft kind of riposte. This is a very specific example, and our influence in the Ukraine, which is much resented.
But there, and in the heart of your own new book, Stalin's Ghost, is the interpretation and presentation of history that's critical.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's part of that's what this is about. Sounds goes, it's about the, you know, who controls history controls the future. And if he can remake Stalin, and who has, to begin with, recently a 53% approval rating in among the Russian people.
He does today, is that right?
Yes. So we're not dealing with completely whitewashing him. He's half whitewashed. He's whitewashed up to his waist already.
And what about the great nation concept? Of course, Putin has dealt in that, and he's not the only one. Tatiana says, "What do we mean by great nation?"
Well, you know, it's a wonderful question to ask, and what most Russians would say, well, at least get back to the empire established by Ivan the Terrible. And when Russians look back at their history of their leaders, they look at who they count quite often as the great leaders are Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Stalin, and the rest are pissants as far as they're concerned.
So that's what makes the great country. Oh, boy. Okay. Tatiana, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another from Gwynn, Michigan. Dennis is on the line. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air with Martin Cruz-Smith.
Hi. I think you are both masters of your respective crafts.
Oh, you're very kind. He's got the big sales, though, my friend. What do you say?
I'm just wondering how Mr. Cruz-Smith would have thought Ronald Reagan would have dealt with Mr. Putin.
Oh, I love it.
Maybe vice versa.
Yeah, I love it. What do you say, Martin Cruz-Smith? You've been around for both eras.
Well, in both eras, there was such a lack of reality as to who Russia was. Back in 1973. I was in Russia, and what struck me was that nobody had described this place as it was. It was falling apart. It was rusting in place, and it was a danger more to itself than to anybody else. And that was in 73. So I think that what we have here are we have leaders who have a great deal of difficulty ascertaining reality and what a genuine danger is. So
when Reagan called out Russia, you're saying he didn't see through to some core reality. He thought they were the great massive bear when he called them out. It looked as though he sensed the weakness behind that. At least in retrospect,
we outspent them. We went into an arms rearmament that they could not afford to do, and so they went to their knees, and we just went into debt. But I'm trying to think now. There was something. The thought will come back.
Well, let me ask you, though.
Like a migrant bird.
Right. Dennis asks for a hypothetical. The president won't trade in those R's anyway, but you're a novelist. You can. What if it were Ronald Reagan, facing Vladimir Putin, inviting him to the ranch with Nancy?
Well, Ronald Reagan would say something like, there is no word in Russian for freedom, when of course there is. It's svoboda. And it's a little bit like a Russian leader coming in. There's no word in the English language, in American English language, for svoboda, which means freedom. I mean, he would deal with it and in sort of extremes and cartoons. I mean, Ronald Reagan hastened the collapse by 1%, but he did play his role much better than anybody else.
Dennis, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Ellen in West Boylston, Massachusetts. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to call and say I love your program all the time. I listen.
Thank you.
I love Martin Cruz Smith. And I was just wondering how he got the information for his book on Wolvesy Dogs, I think was the name, about Chernobyl. Thank you very much, and I'm so glad that you've written another one. I'm always waiting.
Great.
Thank you.
We'll pick it up. Martin Cruz Smith, what about your research? I mean, I was amazed to learn Gorky Park, you'd only been in Russia for a week. You had help from Russians, but you didn't have much direct exposure with Wolves Eat Dogs and the Chernobyl ruins. Or after Gorky Park, how much access and direct research have you been able to do?
Well, I was in and around Chernobyl for about 5 days. And so I stayed there, and I visited a number of the so-called black villages. I did not go inside the reactor. I was across the street from the reactor, and I thought I don't really need to go inside.
The black villages are those that still unsafe from radioactivity, but re-inhabited.
Re-inhabited by some very sweet old people who make a particularly vicious kind of moonshine. And I think these two things sort of go together. They live on the, you know, having been in and around Chernobyl, I've been in some villages, for example, where I would go. It was a snowstorm, and I was standing in this wonderful cemetery, and suddenly this huge stag went bouncing by me, and I'd never seen one that big before, and that's how big they get now in Chernobyl, simply because man is not there to cull them.
It's not a radioactive boost to the growth hormones or something.
No. And then I heard this sound, a weird clanking sound in this deserted village, and out of the woods came a little old woman pushing a baby stroller, and in the stroller was firewood that she'd cut down, and I talked to her. And she lived alone in the village. Everyone else was gone. And she locked the door at night, and she heard the wolves. Mm. But she felt safe, and she didn't worry. And then she pushed her stroller on. It went on. And I thought, the last person on Earth is not going to be some heroic figure. It's not going to be some sort of Superman. It's going to be someone like this little old lady pushing her stroller full of firewood. And that's the kind of thing that you only find, you only see if you're there. So what I do is it doesn't matter quite so much how long I'm there, but I have to touch the ground.
There, in that case, in the shadow of Chernobyl's nuclear meltdown, for a while you were persona non grata on this turf. What about today, when Russia's, you know, at least its elites are rolling in money? They're working all kinds of games and business around the world. Do they even care if you're in town or not anymore? How are you received when you go to Russia? Are you read there?
It used to be that I was read only in Samizdat, and possession of that would cost you a couple of years in jail. And now I'm simply one of 1,000 books that's published. And so it's better, yes, but it's lost a certain fizz.
Though it's got a lot of fizz on the crime side, and you're taking advantage of that. Let's go to Tom in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Martin. I'm another fan. I just wanted to say I look forward to your books coming out. And I just had a question, because it seems to me that Polar Star in particular, but also Red Square, which isn't mentioned as often, would make great movies. And I'm just curious whether you've ever been approached to have one of those made into a movie.
Polar Star 89, Red Square 92. You've had kind of a mixed interaction with Hollywood. What do you say, Martin Christmas?
Well, I've had not a really great experience with Hollywood yet, because the Gorky Park tended to be for me, it was a British film. It had a British director, a screenwriter. Most of the cast was British.
Some British films are great, but this one, it couldn't say so, really.
Well, I couldn't say so, because what it lost was it wasn't American or Russian either. It was cold. The screenwriter, the British screenwriter named Dennis Potter, an excellent screenwriter, but he drained all the humor and warmth out of the story.
And Renko. Mm-hmm.
And Renko. And Renko is in his way a fairly has a somewhat comic take on things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that didn't work out. But it wasn't quite as bad as a film I had called Nightwing, which was pre-Renko.
This and was what, vampires and Indians and Native Americans and...
Yes, and it was not on the level of Gorky Park, but it paid for me for me to write Gorky Park, so I still owe it. But I pulled into the studio lot there, and this guy comes out in this Indian gear, and he says who he is. He's the star of the film, and he says, "I just want to apologize for what we're doing to your book."
And ouch.
That was the beginning. That was the beginning of a long
day.
Nice
to see you too.
So my relations with Hollywood have been rocky, and part of the problem with the Renko books is that they all have Arkady Renko.
Well,
the studio that made Gorky Park the film mm-hmm. has a claim on it, and it gets complicated.
If I'd only given
Arkady a different name for each book, life would be simpler. But I couldn't bring myself to abandon him.
But who knew back in Gorky Park days that Russia was going to become the permanent, well, not only focus of your writing life, but such a central one? You didn't start out as a Sovietologist. When you look back across these years now, are you happy, or do you feel a prisoner of Russia, that it's made such a place for itself at the heart of your life and work?
Well, it's difficult not to write another Arkady, and I know that that's what the publishers did dearly hope, but I have to write what interests me. At the same time, I'm fascinated by Russia, and the fact that here I am reading about Pushkin just because he's not going to figure in anything, but just because it's a window into one of the most fascinating societies on Earth, and one that counts itself as sort of, it still thinks of itself as the third Jerusalem, if you can imagine that. It still thinks of itself as the leader in the world, if it only can throw off its shackles. And that's something that right now Putin is playing up to.
And with Arkady Renko standing, at least in your world, in the wings, it's always a fascinating read, and we're really grateful for the Russia that you've pulled up for our eyes. Grateful for the new book as well. Martin Krusmith, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The new book is Stalin's Ghost. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my great pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.